You're a thief too. Those are the words that got Serena Williams the violation that cost her an entire game at the U.S. Open Women's Final and put her even further into a hole against Naomi Osaka, who was playing the game of her life. Williams eventually lost in straight sets. But in a way, Osaka lost too.
I know that everyone was cheering for her, and I'm sorry it had to end like this.
Osaka, who's Japanese and Haitian and raised in the United States, became the first player from Japan to win a Grand Slam title. But it was how Williams was treated by the umpire and how it was distinctly different from how men are treated in professional tennis that ended up grabbing the headlines.
Do you have any rules in there? Stop showing me your hands, okay? Don't tell me to be quiet, okay? When I want to talk, I talk, all right? I don't give a shit what he said. I just say to you, he's waiting too long.
In many of these instances, male players received no penalties for their displays of anger, even when they seemed extreme.
Come on, please, look at it! Once! Once! Look at it!
How can you not call the ball on the line? Why not? I
have to accept this. That's two aces I've hit. The match would be over right now. 30-15, I hit an ace. 34, I hit an ace.
So why was Serena singled out? I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Joining me now in the studio is Renee Stubbs, a retired Olympic tennis player with Grand Slams to her name. Renee, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So many questions from me. Before we get into the meat of the conversation, which of course we'll be talking about racial and gender dynamics and everything else, there are questions, I think, about just what happened yesterday. So in your experience, how common is it for tennis players to be sanctioned in the way Serena was when there's a referee call? Well, there were three in this instance, but how common were these sanctions? Can you give us a sense?
Well, okay, so, you know, look, players get warnings all the time, whether it be for coaching, whether it be for bad language, whether it be for breaking rackets, hitting a ball out of the stand. So there's different dynamics and code violations. This was a violation that the umpire deemed to be coaching from the stands. The problem is every single coach coaches from the sidelines without question. There's not one player that will tell you that's not true, and there is not one coach that will tell you that is not true. As a player, you know often that an umpire will tell you as a player, I saw your coach, you have to tell him to stop. So they give you a soft warning, as we call it. Your job as an umpire is to control the situation, and he lost control of that situation by giving a coaching warning from the beginning. Serena then ensued after losing the set, being very angry with the fact that she felt an injustice being called against her, because Serena's one of the very few players that doesn't even call coaches onto the court on the WTA tour. So when she got the second warning with the breaking of the racket, that's two code violation warnings, and the second one will give you a point penalty. The third violation for me was also really bad, because I know Serena. She's not afraid to drop the F-bomb. You heard in that soundbite before we came on, that was Roger Federer. The second voice was Roger Federer, who's deemed to be one of the nicest, fairest, kindest guys in the world. He dropped the F-bomb, I believe, three times to the umpire and was not given a violation. Serena, I know in her heart, wanted to drop as many F-bombs as possible at that moment, but didn't. She stayed in control. The last thing she said was, you're a liar and a cheat, because she did feel that way from the beginning.
I want to introduce our second panelist here. We're also joined by Soraya McDonald, who's a culture critic for ESPN's The Undefeated. Soraya, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And you wrote a fantastic piece about what exactly went down yesterday. So I'm curious to hear your reaction, because I want to know, is it possible for us to even talk about what happened before we get into the racial and gender dynamics, like just from a strictly technical standpoint?
I'm not sure that it is, because they're so intertwined. And Arthur Ashe Stadium is a venue that has a pretty rocky history for Serena Williams, even though she's won Grand Slam titles there before. She's had incidents in 2004 and 2009 with just bad officiating. And it basically has sort of created the context for what happened Saturday.
Now let's get into really what I think is keeping this conversation going is Serena Williams, the greatest athlete, many would argue, of all time, not just tennis player, but one of the greatest athletes, has been treated very differently in the tennis world. Tell us about that.
She has. And this was something that her father anticipated when he began training Serena and her older sister Venus when they were children. You know, he would have passersby when they were practicing on these dilapidated courts in Compton. He would have them come by and basically ask them to scream slurs or insults at them, basically to sort of build up this mental toughness, because he was anticipating the sort of reaction that these two Black girls were going to get once they really started playing in this like very white arena of top level tennis. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. You know, I think the most famous example is at Indian Wells when Venus pulled out because of an injury when she was supposed to play Serena. And, you know, the crowd just sort of erupts in boos and starts yelling racial slurs, just really terrible things at Richard Williams himself, which led to this like years-long boycott. They did not go back to Indian Wells.
Yeah, she was playing against Kim Clijsters. The crowd was very parochial against her in that match. And she was young, much like what Naomi Osaka had to deal with the other night as well. I think we forget about Naomi in this conversation. This is a kid who grew up really here, playing in New York with Haitian father, Japanese mother. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we sort of have lost in this dynamic that the crowd, because I was there, it was really loud. It was really tough to actually be in that environment. And this kid is, you know, I felt really sorry for her because she was actually the better player on the night at that point. And you've taken away that moment for her to actually win that match legitimately. She ended up winning it legitimately by serving the match out. But still, you take away that moment for such a young kid. And that's what Serena had to deal with 20 years ago. And I think on the dais with the trophy, I think Serena felt that moment to put her arm around Naomi, because she understood what that also felt like, to have a crowd so parochially against her. And what happened in Indian Wells was a disgrace back 20 years ago.
Good evening, everyone, and we welcome you to the trophy celebration of the United States Open.
I just want to tell you guys, she played well, and this is her first Grand Slam.
One of the things that really stood out to me was how emotional this was for both women. As a woman of color myself, watching this, the pain that it felt to me that both of these women were in, not just Serena.
It was so painful.
It was painful.
Yes.
I mean, people were saying they were crying. Like, it was really intense to watch.
I know that everyone was cheering for her, and I'm sorry it had to end like this.
Why do you think it was so intense for us to watch these two women in particular deal with this?
So I think part of it actually is that Naomi Osaka has been like very open about how much she just loves and adores Serena Williams. The other part is that you're witnessing this sort of disrespect that's being thrust upon Serena Williams that has happened sort of repeated times at Arthur Ashe Stadium at the U.S. Open, and always from the officials. And that doesn't just say something about Serena Williams, that also sends a broader message to the other Black women who are playing in the sport, who are now dominating in the sport, who are basically going to be the future of it. And so when you see Serena being so publicly humiliated, part of that is saying, don't be like her, right? They're making an example of her. You know, I think Serena respects Naomi as a competitor and sees a lot of herself in her. And so I think part of what we want to make sure that we do is differentiate, like, I don't think Serena has any problems playing against, you know, someone who is as talented and as competitive as Naomi, especially because she looks to the Williams sisters as her heroes and her role models in the sport.
Well, she also lost to Serena. Serena lost to Naomi earlier in the year. It was, of course, a time that she was just coming back, but she's now lost to her two times. She plays very similarly to Serena. She can back her up with the serve. She can hit the ball as big from the baseline. She's moving better. This is a kid that'll be around a long time. But, you know, in the end, what happened was the overlying answer or, you know, questions here were the umpire overstepped his boundaries earlier in this match, and that's really what caused all of this problem from the beginning.
We've talked about anger and rage here on The Takeaway and women and how women generally are penalized. Now, when you add race to the equation, we're still, you know, there's that added level of she's not just angry, she's an angry black woman, right? I'm wondering, because of how Serena handled this after the game.
For me to say thief and for him to take a game, it made me feel like it was a sexist remark. But I'm going to continue to fight for women and to fight for us to have equal. Like, Courtney should be able to take her shirt off without getting a fine. Like, this is outrageous, you know? And I just feel like the fact that I have to go through this is just an example for the next person that has emotions and that want to express themselves and they want to be a strong woman. And they're going to be allowed to do that because of today. Maybe it didn't work out for me, but it's going to work out for the next person.
I wonder, does this move the stereotype back a little bit? Are we somewhere different today than we were on Saturday when it comes to viewing black women as angry black women on the court or anywhere else in our society? Because I wonder if her standing up and saying, no, this is wrong, has that, do you think, changed minds a little bit?
Gosh, I hope so. I'm not sure. Because I certainly have, you know, I've gotten a number of messages myself saying, you are completely wrong, she's out of line, with no sort of grace given to the broader implications of this situation. The other thing I think that is important to remember is that, especially when you consider the history of what black women have been through as Americans, you know, being considered property, basically for hundreds of years, zero agency over our own bodies, over when we lactate, over when we reproduce, over just the beauty standards that exist in our culture and the way they specifically malign black women. We basically have like this hangover from all of these things that we're still dealing with. And then you say, well, how dare you react to those things? How dare you have any sort of emotions about those things? How dare you be angry?
And I think black women
have plenty to be angry about.
Right.
That's the other thing, right? Like, that's the part of femininity that is so idealized, right? That you're not supposed to be confrontational. You're supposed to be the peacemaker. You're supposed to be the one who makes everything better and soothes everyone's feelings. And Serena's, you know, basically saying, no, I'm not going to do that. Mm-hmm. It's unfair. No one expects men to do this. No one expects this level of sort of gendered diplomacy from male athletes.
Soraya McDonald is a culture critic for ESPN's The Undefeated. Soraya, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Tanzina.
And Renee Stubbs is a retired tennis player from Australia. Renee, thanks so much for your insights.
You're welcome.
Hi, this is Chloe from Seattle. Shame on Serena and shame on the crowd that booed young Naomi Osaka at the award ceremony. Serena doesn't need a fine. She needs a lesson in grace and sportsmanship.
Mark Dressler from San Juan Capistrano, California. Listen, it's such a double standard. I think the head umpire overreacted, which was really a shame, mainly because it tainted Naomi Osaka's victory.
Hi, this is Andrea calling from suburban Philadelphia. I think what happened in the women's finals of the Open was overkill. I don't understand why a player is penalized for what her coach does, nor do I understand why the penalty involves creating an asterisk situation for the winner by giving her a game and a point advantage so that her win will never be seen as real and unaided.
This is Patty calling from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Serena Williams had an opportunity to look like a leader and be a good role model in tough times, and she blew it.
Hi, my name is Suzanne. I'm calling from Palm Harbor, Florida. For starters, the chair judge owes Serena an apology at the very least. Everyone loves to celebrate the mouthy male tennis players, such as John McEnroe, who gets away with far more than Miss Williams was allowed to. And in the end, she was a graceful loser, but she had a right to fight for her game and her record while on the court of play. I hope that things work out better for her.
My name is Maya, and I'm calling from Chicago. I am incensed that Serena Williams was treated the way she was, and that so many people in conversation about the issue are completely denying the factors of racism and sexism that are at play when a black woman is involved in an incident like this.
But let's leave the last word to U.S. Open champion Naomi Osaka.
When I step onto the court, I feel like a different person, right? I'm not a Serena fan. I'm just a tennis player playing another tennis player. But then when I hugged her at the net, Sorry. Anyways, when I hugged her at the net, I felt like a little kid again.
Thanks for checking out the Takeaways podcast. I know there are like hundreds of podcasts out there, so we really appreciate you choosing ours. And if you like what you hear, why not help spread the word? And you leaving us a rating or a review on iTunes will definitely help us stand out from the pack. Thanks in advance. Now back to the show.
The Trump administration is now looking for a way to implement its zero-tolerance policy at the border without separating families. In another bid to detain and deport as many people who cross the border as possible, the administration is planning to propose a regulation that would roll back a federal judge's long-standing decree known as the Flores Settlement. That agreement limits the amount of time migrant children can be held in detention to 20 days. Yagana Torboti covers immigration for Reuters, and she joins me now to explain this rule, why the Trump administration wants to bypass it, and what the consequences could be. Hi, Yagana.
Thanks for having me.
So the issue at the center of the story is the Flores Settlement, which is an agreement from federal courts more than 20 years ago. Remind us about this Flores Settlement, please.
So this was a sort of long-running litigation that went back to the 80s, but they finally reached a settlement in 1997. And it effectively places a sharp limit on the number of days that a child, a minor child, can be held in detention. And at first, it only applied to children who entered by them. It now basically applies both to children who entered the country, crossed the border alone, as well as those who entered with their parents or with some sort of adult. And so, you know, for the past year or so, the Trump administration has been trying to find ways around this settlement. It's both asked the court to roll back some of its provisions, and now through this proposed regulation, they are sort of making their first real serious move to effectively end the settlement.
And the Trump administration has used Flores to justify their policy of separating kids from their parents at the border, have they not?
Right. So what they say basically is that by the terms of the Flores Agreement, we cannot hold parents and children together in detention. And so if we want to avoid what they call catch and release, which is a policy that they really, really dislike, which is essentially when a family crosses the border, detaining them initially, but then having to release them because there's not enough room in immigration detention facilities, releasing them during while their immigration court proceedings move forward, they want to avoid that. And so what they've said is that because of the Flores Settlement and the limitations that it places on what the government can do, we have to separate families. We have to essentially detain the adult migrants indefinitely while their court proceedings go forward, while we send the children to sort of licensed facilities in the least secure setting possible, sort of shelters or foster care. And of course, advocates and even some federal judges say, well, you don't really have to separate those families. You could just release them. But that, again, as I mentioned, that's something that the administration just really doesn't want to do.
And we've also seen other administrations in the past push back on Flores. Is what the Trump administration is doing different?
What they're doing is different in that no other administration has actually, over the last two decades, actually presented regulations that would terminate the agreement, and they've all had the right to. That's actually written into the agreement itself, that the way to sort of come to the end of this consent decree is for the government to propose regulations that effectively put it into practice. And so, you know, seeking to get out of the main core requirements of Flores is something new that the administration is doing. And of course, a lot of immigration advocates and advocates for those migrants have a lot of problems with the way that the government is going about it.
And this proposal from the Trump administration would also determine where children can be held, right?
basically what they're trying to do, the biggest change is, as I see it, is they're trying to essentially create a new sort of licensing scheme. So currently children can be held in facilities that are licensed by state authorities to hold children. What the government essentially, what the administration wants to do is create a scheme where some third party, and who that may be is sort of to be determined, but some third party that is employed by the Department of Homeland Security can effectively give its approval for a facility to hold children. And therefore, that would allow the government to increase the number of beds it has available in facilities that can technically hold children, and therefore it would not have to release as many families who cross the border. So the concern really is that, you know, who would this third party be? What would those standards be that are in place? You know, is the government going to really be holding children in detention for months and months, even if it's a place that has schools and playgrounds and all sorts of other facilities for children? There are a lot of studies that show that, you know, detention for children is harmful even for short periods. And so those are kind of the main concerns that people are raising, and, you know, saying that this is really not in the spirit of the Flores Agreement.
Well, and the whole reason Flores exists is because of the physical and emotional harm that's done to children when they're detained for long periods of time. Has the Trump administration acknowledged that?
I mean, what they've said in the regulation is that if they move forward with this, it will abide by the spirit of the Flores agreement. And even more than that, they've said that it effectively maintains the same standards for detention of children that are maintained in the Flores settlement. I think, though, that for the sort of the same reasons I said before, people would really disagree with that. They would say that, you know, any kind of detention of children is harmful to their development. It's one thing to detain a migrant who's crossed the border indefinitely while their immigration proceedings continue, and it's a completely different thing to detain children. One, usually children are not held at fault for the actions of their parents if they're minors. And secondly, the developmental process that goes on when a child is very young can really be thrown off track by even a month or 2 months or however, you know, much, much longer of detention.
Yagana Torbati covers immigration for Reuters. Yagana, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
The political, economic, and social crisis in Venezuela continues to worsen by the day. And over the weekend, the New York Times reported that the Trump administration has been actively discussing plans with rebel Venezuelan military officials to stage a coup against current President Nicolas Maduro. Nicholas Casey is the Times' bureau chief for the Andes. Nick, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with what was the extent to which the U.S. government actually discussed these coup plans? Was the Trump administration excited for making this happen?
Well, the administration met several times with rebel Venezuelan military officers representing a group that was both current and people who weren't in the military anymore, who were interested in overthrowing Maduro. And one of their main frustrations was that they couldn't get an answer from the White House as to whether they were interested in this plan or not. They sent the White House someone in what they called listening mode to essentially gather intel on what was being discussed, what they were talking about, hear their requests, which included encrypted radios, and relay that back to the White House. But ultimately, they didn't get any response from the White House that they wanted.
And I'm wondering, why want to work with the United States on something like this? I mean, are the history that the United States has with Latin America and toppling governments is not exactly a great one, right, Nick?
It's not. There's been a long history of coups, rebellions, and other sorts of machinations that were supported by the U.S. But in some part, this may have been one of the reasons that had interested the coup plotters. Specifically, there was a moment last year, last August 2017, when Donald Trump said that he was interested in a military option for Venezuela that could potentially end Maduro's presidency. This was heard by a number of Venezuelans who were already plotting against Maduro. And that's when they decided that perhaps the U.S. might be interested in helping, giving advice. They were never interested in a military intervention as such, but they wanted to know what the U.S. thought about their plan.
Now, what would the U.S. have to gain or lose by participating in something like this?
Well, the U.S. is very worried right now about Venezuela, as is everybody in the region right now. Nicolas Maduro has become a dictator in this area. He's held an election to extend his term, which few people consider to have been valid and many consider to have been rigged. And meanwhile, the crisis of food, medicine, the economic mismanagement of the country has sent millions of people flooding out of Venezuela into its border. So when the U.S. is looking at it, it's seeing a crisis that's already in process and perhaps a bigger one that's in the making. And really, I think what these meetings show is that the U.S. is trying to look at what the different options have been and who might be behind them.
And so in the piece that you wrote for the New York Times, you said that the U.S. government was apprehensive in working with some of these rebel Venezuelan military officials because of their ties to drug trafficking and human rights abuses. Tell us about the nature of these rebel factions.
Well, the Venezuelan military has been accused by the U.S. of all manner of crimes, including drug trafficking, as you mentioned, human rights violations, repressing protesters. The list really goes on. So these characters, as seen by the U.S., are questionable, many of them. And one of them in particular that was a source on this story was actually sanctioned, is under, you know, sanctions from the OFAC, which is from the Treasury Department. So these are not necessarily emissaries of democracy, but I think that the U.S. also realizes that they're some of the few interlocutors that it does have, given that the opposition in Venezuela is very weak. Popular protests have failed on the streets because Maduro has cracked down on them. And there just seem to be very few options, including elections don't seem to be an option right now in Venezuela anymore, given the level of control that the Venezuelan government has over them.
Now, of course, we know that Venezuela has been dealing with this type of instability for a while. In fact, there have been a couple of high-profile attacks against high-level Venezuelan government officials. There was a drone attack that took place in August. There was a helicopter attack from last year. Do you know, Nick, if the United States knew about these attacks or plans for these attacks and if they were supported by the U.S.?
We've never had any reason to believe Ernesto Londoño, my colleague that reported the story as well, and me, that the U.S. knew of the drone or the helicopter attacks. From all it seems, these were fairly amateurish attacks, and the ones that were potentially being planned as coups were much more extensive, involved the military. That said, there's not a lot of information out on who was behind specifically the drone attack against Maduro. The helicopter attack, which took place last year, the person behind that was a rebel police officer, and he's said to me, at least before he was killed, that he never had any contact with the U.S. So we're still getting more information on what happened there, but we don't have any that leads us to think that the U.S. was behind, knew of, or was involved in planning those attacks.
This seems like a particularly desperate move. Is this one of the last attempts by officials or former officials or military folks in Venezuela to try and get things on the right track? And if this does not succeed, then what?
Well, yeah, as you pointed out, the fact that a country would be considering a military coup, or the military would be considering that, the fact that the U.S. would be sitting down with these people shows just how far along this crisis has gotten, how many avenues that you would normally use to change power, elections, protests, have been closed at this point. Is this going to be tried again? Perhaps. Many of the coup plotters have been jailed at this point, and it's not clear how they would go ahead and move forward with any new plans of a coup. But the country is extremely unstable right now. As we've already talked about, there's been an assassination attempt on Maduro using a drone. It's just impossible to say what might be the next step in the history of this place.
Nick Casey is the New York Times bureau chief for the Andes. Nick, thanks again.
Thanks so much, Tanzina.
Hey, teens, how do you use social media?
This is Cameron Popolo from Jacksonville, Florida. I primarily use Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, and YouTube. I've had a generally good experience on all social media platforms, and if you play your cards right, you're able to avoid a lot of negativity on the internet. Many parents and adults can view our social media as distractions, which they can be, but primarily they're tools. We can use them as a method of communication and gathering information on what is happening around us, but they do also play a significant role in our relaxation, as we can watch shows, talk to friends, and connect with those around us.
Hey, this is Nia from McKinney, Texas. I typically use Pinterest, WeHeart It, and Snapchat. Pinterest is great to get my creative juices flowing. WeHeart has great song lists and is good for sharing ideas. Snapchat is good for keeping in touch with my friends, but sometimes we take advantage of the 24-hour rule of Snapchat.
According to a new survey, 70% of teenagers are using social media multiple times a day, compared to just a third of teens 6 years ago. And fewer than a third of teens think communicating in person is ideal.
I have three teenagers myself. My kids are 17, 16, and 13, and I am dealing with this issue on a daily basis.
That's Colby Zintel. She's vice president with Common Sense Media, a San Francisco-based nonprofit that tracks teen social media use in the United States.
Each of my kids have a smartphone, which holds up with the data from Common Sense, which says that 89% of kids in the U.S. Now own a smartphone. And each of my kids have a laptop, which they use at school and then they use at home. And so part of my issue is trying to figure out when my kids are offline and how I can get them to not use their devices so much. I mean, whether it's on social media or playing games, my kids are using either their mobile devices or their laptops almost all day long. And it's frustrating as a parent.
So in Colby's house, they set some rules.
The hardest rule to keep, I would say, is no devices in the bedroom. That's really hard when you're a parent of three teenagers and they've all got homework all day long. The rule that we use that's really much easier is we have a device-free dinner as often as we can. At home together, no devices allowed at the table. And it's just a nice half an hour of time that we have with our family where we can talk to each other without the distraction of social media or our devices.
So 6 years ago, you guys did a study, and it's 6 years later. What have you noticed? What are the changes? Are teens better or worse when it comes to social media?
Well, I think it's safe to say, and as a parent of teenagers, I think everyone, this might be obvious, but social media has thoroughly taken over our teenagers' social life. Social media literally does not exist without teenagers today, and their relationship with the platforms are complex and varied.
And are there specific platforms that young people today, or younger people, if you will, are flocking to? I know Facebook has suddenly become the platform for older folks, if you will. I think a lot of teenagers don't go on Facebook anymore. So where are they going?
Yeah, so it's all about Instagram and Snapchat with teenagers today. I mean, last time we did this report in 2012, Facebook was the platform. But now they've all moved on and gone to Snapchat and Instagram. So something like over 60% of the kids are on it, and they're on it several times a day.
Now, those of us who didn't grow up with social media have our own opinions, I think, about social media use. But this is a generation that was born into it. What are their attitudes about the role that social media has in their own lives?
Yeah, so teenagers, actually, they love social media. No surprise there. They're on it multiple times a day. And they actually reported in the survey that it actually makes them feel pretty good about themselves, less lonely, less depressed. You know, parents have a lot of anxiety about how teenagers use social media and what the impact is on them. And the teenagers basically told us, you know what, we're fine.
But are they fine? I mean, some of them are fine, but there are also teenagers who are bullied and harassed on these platforms. What about them?
You're right about that. And so, you know, what we found was that the teenagers are exposed to cyberbullying. And, you know, actually the number of kids who are exposed to hate speech and misogyny and racism, the focus group said if they could see what we see on social media, if our parents could see what we see on social media, it would make them cringe. So what we need to do is look at every kid on a case-by-case basis and see that, you know, if they're doing okay, because social media has a tendency to have an amplifying effect. So it can make your life better if you're, a kid with a high social emotional well-being factor, or it could make it worse if you're a kid that has a tendency toward depression, anxiety, loneliness, etc.
And I'm wondering if this is something that is somewhat biased towards the teenagers themselves because they self-reported this, right? What do you think about that? Is that enough to get a full picture?
Yeah, so the teenagers, they did self-report. And I think that it's really important as we look at all this data to take it into consideration that, you know, what the teenagers have to say about how social media is affecting them. I think, you know, one thing that we need to think about is how often they're using social media, because parents are so worried about the fact that their kids are on their devices all day, and the kids are self-reporting that it's distracting and that it, you know, it distracts them from homework, it distracts them from face-to-face conversation. And so as parents, what we could do is really help them self-manage and be more aware of the impact that social media is having on their day-to-day life, on their relationships, on their ability to do homework, on their ability to sleep. And really, as parents, our job is to pay attention to what the kids are saying and then apply. You know, every kid is different, and teenagers especially are complex kids. You know, this data bears that out. And it's our job to make sure that the kids have a healthy relationship with social media.
Is it realistic, though, really, Colby, to suggest that parents can even control or be aware of what their children are encountering online? I feel like once we, you know, there used to be a time when there was one phone in a home, right? And anyone who called that home, you know, had to sort of go through one or two people. But everybody has their own device these days. So how can parents even be aware of what their kids are going through when they're not controlling the device itself?
You know, so I am a parent of teenagers, and I understand this exactly. You know, all of my kids, they have a smartphone and they have a computer, and you know that they're being exposed to this. And unfortunately, they're being exposed to it in their bedrooms because that's where they're doing their homework and they're on their devices. As a parent at Common Sense Media, what we basically say is you have to teach those kids instead how to respond to what they're seeing online. And so how to be digital citizens is what we say at Common Sense, how to stand up when you see cyberbullying, when you see hate speech, and really how to respond appropriately online rather than saying, I have to cut this off from my child because, you know, I don't know what they're going to see online. We have to teach kids these skills because, let's face it, social media is not going away. And the kids are using it. More than 70% of them are checking it several times a day. Some of them say they're online constantly. And so what we need to do is meet the kids where they are and then teach them how to behave appropriately when they come across some of the tricky stuff.
You mentioned that kids are online almost all the time in some instances. And I'm wondering what that's doing for their development. They're still learning. They're still growing. These are children who, you know, are they becoming more distracted? Is this having an impact on the way that they're able to process information?
So I would say that that is an interesting finding that we saw from the report, because the kids did say that they are increasingly distracted. They're distracted when they're doing their homework. They're distracted when they are with their friends, and that they found that that was frustrating for them. And as parents, we all worry about things like social media's impact on, you know, kids' social and emotional well-being. Parents worry about device addiction, cyberbullying, eroding social skills. These are all huge concerns of parents. And I think what we need to do, as I said, was meet the kids where they are and say, if this is distracting you from your homework or from doing something that's more important, how can we be more mindful about device use? And how can we put your device down and do something, say, with focused attention? Or, you know, maybe you have a device-free dinner time or a device-free bedtime. And parents can do a lot to try to alleviate some of their own concerns about their kids' device use. And then, you know, sometimes when you take the phone away, while a teenager may say that they're angry about that, they might secretly be relieved.
And I guess parents will also have to do this by example as well, putting their own phones down. Would you agree?
Totally. And, you know, in research report after research report that we do at Common Sense, the kids all say that the way that their parents use their devices not only sets an example, but is frustrating for the kids themselves. We did a report several years ago that said that teenagers are interacting with the screen as much as 9 hours a day. Well, guess what? Grown-ups are interacting with screens 9.5 hours a day. So we need to look at our own behavior and see what we're modeling for our teenagers and for our young kids especially.
Colby Zintel is vice president with Common Sense Media. Colby, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.